Minainain Baranin, Malta through international eyes. Colin Fitz here, this is Campus 103.7. Welcome to the show. The series that has been going on for a few years here at Campus 103.7, you can find previous editions on our website, Campus 103.7, in the on-demand page under the Maltese name Minainain Baranin. But to discuss Malta through international eyes, I have a very special guest today, Professor Petra Caruana Dingley, from here, the University of Malta. She's an associate professor at the Edward de Bono Institute for Creative Thinking and Innovation. And she also has a catalogue of books she has published. Welcome, Professor Caruana Dingley.
Hi, Colin. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
And if you don't mind, I'll refer to you as Petra from now on. Thank you. So, let's start with the Edward de Bono Institute for Creative Thinking and Innovation, which is your current position. You're an associate professor there. Perhaps for the benefit also of our international listeners, Edward de Bono is one of our biggest exports.
Yes, sure. I mean, he's very well known internationally, published a huge number of books and, lectured around the world and so on.
A thinker, a philosopher.
Yes. And he basically has had some very well-known ideas that he promoted, six thinking hats, lateral thinking and so on. So, yes, a very well-known name. There is an institute which he was involved in establishing here at the university, which still goes on. We teach a number of subjects there. So I teach there. I've been there since 2014. I also lecture in the Faculty of Arts, where I teach mainly literature, so mainly English literature. So I have sort of two different roles, but my main post is with the Edward de Bono Institute.
Wonderful. You've also held positions such as chairperson of the Imdina Cathedral Archives.
Yes, which I still do.
That's the Imdina Cathedral, of course. The archives there stretch back 1,000 years.
Well, they stretch back to the late medieval period. There's also the Inquisition there, lots of interesting things.
Amazing. Then there's the NGO Dinlart Helwa, that you've been a council member there for many years.
Yes, I've been a council member there since I was basically in my 30s. I was also the president of Dinlart Helwa for a while and vice president, so on. I'm still very involved now. My role is I look after the magazine Vigilo, which we published twice a year.
And you're curator of St. Peter's Monastery Museum in Imdina.
I am involved in the monastery there, yes, as well, and the museum, which was set up now a couple of years ago. So I've been involved in curating that. That's right.
I remember Edward de Bono mentioning different hats. You wear quite a few of them, don't you?
Well, they're different interests, which to me coincide. You know, they may seem like different things, but they're all different interests. And yes, I try to keep up with them.
And I have a list here off the University of Malta website of the books and publications under your name.
Well, I have published. I think a lot of my colleagues here at university probably have published the same and more. So that's part of the whole environment and of working here.
Your research interests include 19th century women writers, creativity in 19th century literature, cultural heritage, women and cultural history, and early modern female monasteries. So many interesting things there. You were also involved with the British Council. You were also involved with the Malta Environment and Planning Authority for some years. I invite our listeners to look you up online, because otherwise we're going to continue listing things. And I want to talk about, for example, the book that made me think you'd be a great guest on this program, Malta Through International Eyes, published, I don't know, about 20 years ago.
2000.
And it was about, over the years, distinguished foreign visitors to Malta and some things that they wrote about this island.
Well, that was Encounters with Malta, which I did with Reverend Professor Peter Serchon-Anglot, who was director here at the university also, not at the time, but he was director also. He was also a supervisor of mine when I was a student. I had started off doing English sociology and philosophy, and he was one of my lecturers and eventually also supervisor for my thesis. So we were quite in touch at around that time. Also, when I did my doctorate, eventually at the University of Oxford. And I had an interest in travel literature. I had already published a couple of things on those lines, also through my interest in literature and moving on to travel literature. Also, a lot of British travellers who travelled to Italy, to Malta, and so on. He also had an interest, and we ended up publishing this book, which is basically a compilation of short biographies of travellers to Malta from the medieval period right until the 20th century. So it's a book which we had done at the time. It was lots of fun doing it. There were various other contributors as well.
Yes.
The main one being Thomas Freller, who has also written a lot about travel literature.
Mm-hmm.
So, so it, I suppose, fits into your interest here in this program as well, because it goes back not so much. It is not so much about contemporary views on Malta, but about the way that Malta has been viewed over many centuries, actually.
Encounters with Malta is the name of the book. Unfortunately, it's no longer in print, but it had sold very well. It's a lovely coffee table style book as well.
It was only printed once at the time, and it's quite a while ago now. But it was fun putting it together, and I think it's still quite relevant. It has a collection, most of the famous people who came, or writers, artists, politicians, knights, lots of different people over a long period of time. So you see how it also changes, approaches change, interests change, and so on. Some might come because they're on the grand tour, some might come because they're a diplomat or some politician or somebody traveling for different reasons. As you get closer to maybe the modern period, you find more people traveling for leisure. That's something which is actually quite later kind of development.
Yes. Some came here to invade, Napoleon.
The book Encounters Malta actually is about people who came and gave some kind of impression or did something here or lived here. Some might have settled here, some might have visited. Obviously, some of them left more documentation about what they saw. So either they wrote journals, they wrote letters, they wrote books, they wrote fiction, maybe mentioning Malta sort of in a more imaginative way. They also painted Malta, drew things. So that's another way they documented. So all of the different ways that they might have, interpreted and remembered and, their impressions of Malta. So along the centuries, it also changes a bit because the interests change as well. So when you see it in that historical way, you see the sort of type of travel changing, type of traveller changing, and the way Malta's documented changes as well. And of course, Malta's changing along the way too, as it still is.
We'll come back to all this a little bit later on, even to the fact that you teach a course about travel writing.
Yeah, well, within the Department of English, we have a course on travel literature. So some of this is touched on, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we'll come back to this a bit later on, but I was very happy to find out when I first met you, as you arrived to be interviewed for the program, that you're actually half German.
Well, my mother's German, yes.
So that fits in perfectly with this program, Malta Through International Eyes, as in you have your Maltese eyes on Germany and your German eyes on Malta as well. I mean, growing up here at the time with a
mother who was not Maltese did make a difference, in the sense now I think there are so many different nationalities in Malta today that it's something which is very, I think not unusual, but at the time it was perhaps more unusual. And yes, so you grew up with also looking at Malta through foreign eyes, even though you are here and Maltese, because you've always got that, other set of eyes with you.
Indeed.
Who is looking at things differently.
Indeed.
So it gives you a different angle.
And these are the kind of people I always seek out in this program, because sometimes you need that slight outsider perspective to be able to look at things without too much emotion.
Well, it gives you a different perspective. I mean, also in the travel narratives and so on that I was mentioning, they are interesting because they are descriptions of Malta which are not by Maltese. Not to say that a description of Malta by a Maltese person is not valid,
absolutely,
but it gives you a different angle, because especially historically, people weren't writing about their everyday lives and what they saw. And even if they did, they had a different interest. They weren't maybe impressed by something they might see in the street, which was just an everyday occurrence. You know, exactly. The way people dressed or the way people spoke or Indeed. The way the buildings were or anything like that. Because for them, that was everyday life and not necessarily worth recording, or it's not what they had foremost on their mind. Whereas a traveler would be looking at those things and has a different perspective because they're also, well, seeing it as something new, seeing it as something different to what they knew at home. So it's something which struck them and therefore they recorded it. So what it gives us now later is a lot of details as well about Malta in the past, which we don't have from anything else. It's a record, if you like, of what Indeed. There was, whether it's in Valletta, whether it's in the countryside or whatever it is, looking at the Maltese people or whatever was going on
Indeed.
And writing about it or drawing it, painting it and so on, which is a very valuable historical record as well. So you can just look at the paintings or read the descriptions. They could be journals, they could be books or whatever it is. And then, of course, if you understand which period it's in, you can understand perhaps even more why they were particularly interested in certain things at certain periods of time or not.
So, Professor Petra Caruana Dingley, Petra, let's go back to your childhood.
Okay.
Did you spend it here in Malta?
I was born in Malta, yes. We traveled to Germany quite a lot every year and, you know, visiting relatives and so on.
May I ask how your parents met? How did
My parents are both doctors, or were. My father's passed away. My father was a gynecologist, obstetrician, and he was working here. My mother had just graduated also as a doctor in Hamburg, came here for a, you know, sort of to work at the hospital here with some other students for a short period. And basically they met at that time. So that was in the early 60s. And then they married in 64. I'm born in 68. So so it was Malta in the 1960s.
You mentioned Hamburg. Is that where your...
the family is originally from Berlin. Second World War, they had moved and she grew up in the north. Yes, near the Baltic Sea, near Lübeck.
Indeed. I was fortunate enough to visit both Hamburg and Lübeck as a student.
Then she studied in Hamburg.
A student exchange. Lübeck is beautiful. So yeah, your childhood...
So I grew up here and then... basically in the late 70s or there was the doctor strike and we had left and moved to Germany for a few years and I went to school there.
This was late 70s.
Yeah, yes. The time of the doctor strike. So then eventually returned and came back, moved back to Malta. Then I went to England for lower sixth form and then I was here again and then later I went to University of Oxford to do my doctorate.
Malta in the 70s was quite old-fashioned. I mean, there was the church was still very powerful. The pace of life was much slower, while Germany was quite an advanced economy. So what differences would you experience as a half-German, half-Maltese young person when you travel between the two countries? What stood out the most for you?
Yeah, I think, I mean, today, as you say, things have changed so much. You can't draw the same comparisons. But when I was a child... Yeah, they were two very, very different worlds because in Germany also, for example, when I went to school there, it was a mixed school. So here I was in an all-girls school. Mm-hmm. As you say, the religious aspect and so on was very different. But also the mentality was different too, yes. Here, young people today can't imagine the sort of social environment that we lived in at that time here. I mean, it was much more... it was a much smaller community and less open-minded, I'd say, about a number of things. It has changed so dramatically. I think that's why a lot of people of my generation and older are even, you know, struggling to recognize the place as it's changed so much over the last, I don't know how long, you know, as much as I, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, you know, there's been a dramatic change.
Indeed.
Both in what we see around us, the kind of people. There are also so many nationalities here now, for example.
Indeed.
Again, if I go back to my childhood, that was not the case. There were not so many nationalities. Okay, there were the British here, I mean, when I was very young and before that, but not the sort of mix of nationalities that are everywhere now.
Indeed.
Now, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It's just very different, you know.
Yeah.
It's a very different place and much, much busier now as well, as you say. It was very, very quiet at the time. I mean, you could, you know, there were hardly any cars or anything. I remember we used to live in St. George's Bay, which has changed so dramatically now. There were just a few houses around.
Indeed.
And it was just a...
And the St.
It was just a valley, you know,
indeed.
Very quiet. I mean,
so
we used to... When we're children play around in the fields, again, that has changed. You won't find any children playing on their own anywhere anymore.
Yeah.
And we used to sort of go home for lunch when we heard the church bells ringing or something. Or if there was a car at night going up the St. Andrew's Road, we would hear it, you know, because it's the only car.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, these are things which... You know, young people can't even imagine. Yeah. So, you know, in our lifetime, things have changed a lot. So, yeah, the Malta of that time was very different.
Yeah.
So, obviously, going to Germany regularly, it was a different world, you know. It's also politically here, it was different. And there were still things like, you know, a lot of shortages of
water,
things,
power cuts.
Water, all that, you know. So, yeah.
We were still very much a developing country.
Well, there were a lot of issues which we took for granted here, which then obviously going away were very different. So, I think anyone who moved between different places, you know, in Europe or people who went to the States or whatever would have seen lots of differences.
Indeed.
So, yeah. And it obviously gives a different perspective also from... And the other thing to note is that people didn't travel so much as well.
Mm.
I mean, people traveled, of course, but, you know, travel was also... less easy, okay? There weren't so many flights. They were more expensive. They were less frequent. It was more of a big deal.
No internet, of course.
It was more of a big deal. So,
yes.
So, anyway, those are all things which you know, made it a very different place.
Did the people know about Malta when you'd be in Germany?
Yeah, I mean, not so many had been here, though.
No.
Again, now you'd meet lots of people who have been for some holiday, and it's very easy to access.
Yes.
It wasn't the case at the time, so... So, yeah, no, definitely, it wasn't so familiar.
When did you make the decision that the rest of your life was going to be in Malta rather than, for example, in Germany, which was... You know,
I don't think I ever took that decision. Things just develop, right? One thing leads to another. I mean, I had just, you know, worked here and carried
on.
And my parents were here, I mean, friends were here, so it just developed, yeah. I never took a decision.
Well, you obviously love Malta very much because you got yourself involved in some of Malta's treasures. Many of Malta's treasures, and have worked very hard. I'm speaking to Professor Petra Caruana Dingley. So from what you've learned over the years, what you've researched, let's start talking about some well-known people who have passed through Malta or visited.
Well, we had started right with that book, Encounters with Malta. So that's a whole spectrum of different people who came. So if you're interested in knowing about how different people see Malta, you know, you get a very good overview there of different periods of time as well. So in the earlier periods, people who traveled, let's say if you go to 15th century, 16th century, 17th century, people are traveling for very specific reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Today, people travel mainly because they're curious, because they're going on holiday, some want to see all the sights wherever, some want to just go to relax. So they go choose somewhere where they're going to just not do very much, but just have some time out. But the further you go back, you find people will travel for quite specific reasons. Yes, because they're interested, they're curious, but it's either what used to be a kind of like the Grand Tour, which is mainly...
Explain for those listening who don't know
what it is.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have a sort of it starts off really as a kind of educational tool. All young men of a certain standing, let's say, in society or whatever, and of course with a certain the ability to do so, okay, financially and in other ways.
In various European countries.
Yeah, in various, in England, German travellers, northern,
French.
Mainly northern.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was part of a young man's education to go and visit some other countries. Obviously, we're talking about a relatively smallish amount of people, but they were usually young men, let's say aged between around 18 and 23. They'd go on a longish trip. These were trips which were not that short.
And
there
of
was
course.
No kind of weekend travel or anything like that. They took a few months. They might even take a couple of years. So they went around quite specific routes. Let's say if you're a British traveller, an English traveller, you'd go across the Channel, you'd go to Paris, you'd go across in various well-known stops along the way. You'd go through Switzerland, you might go down through Italy, again, known stops up till Rome. Some came down as far as Malta. So they would go with, for example, some kind of older person who maybe was there to to look after them or teach them or whatever, some kind of tutor maybe or something like that, or somebody who'd already traveled before.
And remember, what period was this we're talking about?
Well, we're talking about, I'm now thinking of mainly 17th century, so I'm thinking mainly
1600s onwards.
Yeah, around then, even a bit before. These started off mainly as kind of educational things. Mm-hmm. So you would go with quite a specific agenda. You would want to get to know some important people in government or court or wherever, whatever it was. You would want to go to different cities, including, for example, in Switzerland. You'd go to Geneva or here or there. You'd see what kind of fortifications they had, defense. You'd see what kind of economy they had. You'd make some contacts and so on. And you were learning about kind of things, okay, which would then, when you go back home, be useful for you and your career. You would very often write this down so that other people who did not do these trips would read about it. And
so a travel
also
diary.
They were travel diaries. Yeah. So there's a lot of written material like this.
Okay.
And
you'd go to the opera if you went to Milan, for example, or...
Yeah, that would come a bit later, probably, yeah. Because then the trips start out as quite educational trips. They're called Kavalierstour in German, and they were these sort of, as you say, mainly educational trips. Remember, travel was very dangerous. Mm. It was very difficult. It was very expensive. You went along established routes.
Yeah.
Ship and then, you know, horse, carriage, whatever. Yeah. You know, it was long journeys, difficult.
Sailing also, ship as well.
Yeah, sometimes they would go down faster by ship, but they were trips. You sort of had to be a fit young person, really, to be able to do it, come back safely.
And very few women.
Women hardly at all, hardly at all. These were mainly, as I say, and they were there were other kinds of travellers.
It was frowned upon, I suppose. Women were really allowed.
It wasn't part of their expected education either. It's not something which was useful to them later because they didn't have the same kind of careers ahead of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They were more sort of, you know, in the domestic space, and that wasn't part of it. Just wasn't on within that sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Other travellers existed, of course. There were people who were diplomats. There were people who were maybe travelling on pilgrims and things like that. People were traveling for trade, merchants, whatever. So there were other kinds of travelers. But the Grand Tour, as you asked me, was mainly that educational tour, which changes a bit in the 18th century when it starts to become called that, because they were traveling not so much anymore to just find out about, you know, economy, defense, and sort of quite specific things. But they were also going for it as a kind of cultural tour. So they were looking at the ancient remains of Italy, for example. They were starting to become very interested in getting to know artworks and other things. And it becomes more maybe then, it is educational, but it becomes a bit more of a cultural tour as well. Okay? Yeah. And it's a bit more about, you know, if you've been on your grand tour or whatever, and you went home, you had some advantages, because you'd, to those, for example, other young men who hadn't been anywhere, you know, you had seen the world, as we were saying before, travel.
Yes.
I mean,
you'd be able to impress the
ladies. Travel widens
with your stories.
Everything. I mean, travel opens up
indeed
your mind to different experiences.
You'd get more respect. It would look good on your CV, so to speak.
Yeah, basically.
Wouldn't it? Yes.
So that was one kind of trip or one kind of traveler, if you like, at that time.
Yes. So what was it about Malta? And I'm sure you're going to talk about the fact that Malta was ruled by the Knights of St. John, who were young and older men from distinguished families all over Europe. So that's probably part of the reason. But what would attract some of these grand tourers to Malta if they've seen some of the capitals of Europe and the main cities? Why go all the way down to Malta? What would be the added bonus, the added value to their trip?
Besides these grand tours as such, a lot of people did come to Malta because there were the knights. So the knights made it, obviously, you know, somewhere very much of interest for people to see. And a lot of
People in Northern Europe, forgive me for interrupting, but we would have heard about Malta through the exploits of the knights. You know, Sir so-and-so of the royal family of this part of France is not serving as a knight of St. John in Malta, where they had the Great Siege. I believe the story of the Great Siege had circulated.
Yeah, it was very well known.
So Malta was known as this place somewhere in the Mediterranean that would be worth visiting because of the Knights of St. John, mostly.
Well, people who are going on these kind of longer trips around, if they had the health time, finances and everything would carry on then when they were in Rome, Naples, and some might go down Sicily and some might then cross as well and go to Malta, because of course it was a destination which was known because mainly of the Order of St. John, for sure. So some of them would then come here, and also when they were here, there were specific things that they would see. For example, I'm talking now mainly 1600s, 1700s, okay, so roughly.
The knights were here between 1530 and 1798.
Yeah, so they would want to see, for example, they would all see Valletta, they would all go up to, mainly they would go up to Rabat, they would look at the main churches, they would look at St. Paul's Grotto was quite, they would see some of, you know, these kind of sites. Even then there was a kind of there was a kind of schedule, you know.
So Malta being in the Bible and having been visited by St. Paul.
Well, the knights promoted also,
yes.
Grotto and, there were certain destinations here as well. So a traveller, a visitor would come for various reasons, but when they were here, they would go around and see specific things as well. Some, again, would be a bit more adventurous, see something else. A lot of them recorded it. So when we're going back to that book, a lot of them would record what they saw. Some of them, therefore, tend to be recording the same kinds of things, but you get different details. Maybe they're mentioning a different detail that they noticed or not. So if you want to historically understand what Malta was like at that period, you get a lot of the descriptive stuff coming from these travellers. So they're important historical documents in that sense. And obviously, depending on the individual and depending on the period as well, they're looking for and looking at different things. So this changes then, because then if you move into the British period, into the 19th century, you were mentioning women, for example, before. At that time, travel becomes much easier because there is the Industrial Revolution, right? There is steam, so there are steamships, there are trains, railways, all sorts of things like that. So travel becomes... There is also something else which
more
changes.
Accessible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there also start to be what we could call... Well, it's the beginning of a kind of mass travel. I mean, obviously the numbers there are much smaller, but they are organized trips. So you get certain travel operators who are planning your trip for you. So you get, Thomas Cook and all these. These started in the early 19th century, early 1800s. So they start to organize tours so that they would plan for you how you were going to get wherever, where you were going to stay, and so on and so forth. And you get people signing up to these groups and would no longer be traveling, as I was mentioning before, like the Grand Tour. It would be, for example, one particular young man, an aristocrat or whatever he was, who would go with some of his friends, others like him, and maybe a tutor, as I said, and so on. So a small group, and they go wherever. These would be people who sign up to a group, and they find others on that group who are, there were women, there were people from different walks of life, different ages, and so on. So it becomes a much more varied kind of groups who go around. So in terms of general travel, it changes like that. So you get these... It is no longer something which is so unusual to find women or children or younger people traveling. Also, going back to English travelers, Italy was a very, very popular destination at that time, and lots of people used to go and not just travel there briefly and go back, but spend, for example, if they could do it, they would spend the winter there. You know, they'd hire a place, stay in
Venice.
It was very popular. A lot of British artists, Turner famously and others, painted, you know, Venice and other places.
Yes.
And that. Now, Malta's a bit different again to that because, of course, here we had, it was, you know, there was the governed by the British. And
yes.
So, of course, here we also had lots of people who were here for work reasons, right? People who were in the
governors,
in the
administrators,
army,
or
the military,
Navy,
or whatever, you know. So there is a whole load of people who are coming here for a different reason again.
To visit.
Yeah, and with
relatives.
Them also their spouses, maybe their wives, you know, children, families. Mm-hmm. So all of this leaves people who are writing letters home, who are keeping journals, who are writing other stuff. And a lot of that gives information about Malta, which is very valuable to us today, but from a historical point of view, but also very different to what you'd find people who are actually born here, Maltese, who were not documenting the place in the same way because they were interested in different things. Mm-hmm. They weren't walking through the streets of Valletta and noticing that there were, you know, mm-hmm. whatever they were seeing along the way.
Yes.
So this is how it changes. And the people change, the patterns change, and obviously what they're seeing changes as well.
Indeed. Let's take a musical break. We'll listen to some music and continue this very interesting conversation during this edition of Malta Through International Eyes. Min Ainain Barranin. I'm talking to Professor Petra Caruana Dingley, who's the author of various articles, publications over the years, including one in particular that caught my eye called Encounters with Malta, about well-known people in history who have come to or visited or passed through Malta and some of the writings that they left behind about these islands. I'm talking to Professor Petra Caruana Dingley, author of, amongst many other publications and articles, Encounters with Malta, a book specifically about Malta through international eyes, a book that was published in the year 2000. We were talking about the reasons visitors would come to Malta, particularly in the era of the Grand Tour between the 16th and 19th centuries. Perhaps right up to the early 20th century, in fact.
Well, it would no longer be called the Grand Tour, but it's mainly up to the 1700s, really.
Can we have some names?
There aren't just people who were mentioning before, wrote diaries, journals, whatever, but also people who painted and who drew Malta, you know, visual images, which are very well known and important today. I mean, if you go back to the 17th century, we have, for example, Schelling, 1660s, who painted, or he drew and painted anyway, lots of different.
A German artist?
Dutch.
Schelling.
Yeah, Schelling's. Okay. And, these are images of Malta which are very unique and valuable today because he was also very accurate in what he was drawing. So it shows us how different scenes, you know, in Rabat and Valletta and so on were at that period. And then you have others like, for example, Favre. Now, some of these, like him, actually settled here then. So when we're talking about, but they're still foreign eyes, looking at the place. And he, for example, left images of multi-society at that time and, you know, sort of, you know, inside drawing rooms or whatever it was, you know, this kind of interiors. There's also Brokdorff in the early British period who were drawing and painting lots of different scenes of Valletta and elsewhere, which are very important documentation now because they give us those views onto they're not just
not just street views or markets or people sitting on their doorstep.
Also,
but also
like
you mentioned drawing rooms and social.
Well,
events.
Favre did interiors. Mm-hmm. Not all of them did interiors, but mm-hmm. but yes, they show. So this is all
information. Some of the more well-to-do, the aristocracy as well.
Yeah, different, lots of different things, and also countryside and other stuff. So these are sort of, let's say, things of the 18th century and earlier, which give us that. And then you get other people who are here who are also really of note. And for example, in the 1960s and 70s, there were quite a lot of, there was a sort of network, if you like, of artists and writers and so on who particularly liked Malta and Gozo, quiet as it was then. Okay, so they were attracted by this idea of a Mediterranean island and it being very quiet and so on. For example, there was Desmond Morris, famously. Indeed. Julian Trevelyan, the artist. Also,
Desmond Morris, not an archaeologist, wasn't he an anthropologist?
Yeah, exactly. And he wrote about psychology and so on.
Yes.
And then also Montserrat, for example, who wrote The Capellan of Malta.
Nicholas Montserrat.
Yes, so he was in Gozo. And to give you a little bit of an idea of maybe an individual. So he thought that, you know, writers should move around and live in different places because it was very much what we were saying before. Yes. When you go to different places, you get different perspectives. Yes. And so on. And he sort of, some friend, I think it was, who told him, well, you know, there's a Gozo and it's, you know, much too quiet to live in or anything, but, you know, it's quite nice. And he liked the idea of it being very quiet and he thought that would be perfect. So he and his wife, Anne, had got a house in Gozo in San Lorenzo, and they ended up spending, he wanted to come for 5 years, he ended up spending I think 10 or something like that, and then he passed away, and he wrote some really works which remain significant also.
Indeed.
To Malta, because again from his foreign perspective he presented a view, if you like, of Malta and the Second World War and all of that.
Yes.
And with the sort of enthusiasm of researching it and seeing it. And this sort of capellan, this Maltese priest who was also, you know, the protagonist of it. And they ended up staying here anyway, the Montserrat.
Indeed.
Then passed away, and his wife Anne. Yes. Also continued to live in Malta. So, and there were others like this. There was Victor Passmore.
Mm-hmm. If I can interrupt you for a second, I think you'll find this interesting. of all, because you know how Malta, sometimes the name of Malta or something Maltese turns up where you least expect it in some writing or so on television or in a movie or something. And as Maltese, we kind of feel this twinge of, oh, how exciting, oh, Malta's being mentioned. But I was reading the biography of Gene Roddenberry, who's the man who came up with Star Trek. In this biography, there's written that one of the books that he was reading while he was coming up with the concept of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise exploring the universe was The Capellan of Malta, which inspired him somehow. The resilience of the people, the against odds, against all odds, you know, the overwhelming odds of World War II. Gene Roddenberry was reading The Capellan of Malta as he was coming up with the concepts for this science fiction universe that has made so much money and has become so popular around the world, which I thought was really mind-blowing, being a Star Trek fan.
Okay.
I'm thinking, oh, okay, so Malta is partly Malta and Gozo. We're partly responsible for Star Trek. Anyway,
right.
Sorry.
Yeah,
to
no, that was a book which was, you know, very popular.
Yes.
And it still is. You still find it everywhere, you know, for sale and what have you.
It was being read in America, as we say. Yeah. You know,
so those are the fictionalized accounts, you know, and you get, there are all these personal stories, especially because obviously the closer you get in time, the more the writers tend to also leave information about themselves, and it all gets a bit more easy to find out how they responded to things. So people like that, you know, there's quite a lot about his life.
Yes.
And also the Gozo of those days, you know, the 60s, the 70s.
Indeed.
There was also Victor Passmore, another very famous artist who also had bought a house in Malta at that time and lived here. Anthony Burgess as well, who lived in, I think it was Leo or Attard, and we had a house there. And he, again, included Malta in some of his fiction.
And in his non-fiction as well, complaining about the censorship.
That's right,
right,
that's right. There was that, there was obscenity and the arts or something.
Yes.
There was that. So all these, there was a sort of wave, if you like, of that kind of person who had come and lived here for some time, for as artists, writers, and documented Malta at a very different time, obviously, because before I was telling you about how I remember certain things when I was young. I mean, I'm 57, so I'm not young, but it sounds like such a long time ago because it was such a different world. Malta's changed so much.
Indeed, and Gozo...
in this time, you know.
We have seen Gozo change very much in the
Gozo,
last...
Especially.
Gozo retained its character and its sort of aloofness for a longer time than Malta did. When Malta began to develop a lot in the late 90s or through the
90s. Yeah, it's been developing. I mean, I remember, for example, my German grandmother who used to come and visit quite often when I was a child. My mother always says she used to come when my mother had just first moved here and sort of looked around, and there was quite a lot of building going on already in the 60s, not like now, but for then it was. And she said, oh, it'll be nice here when it's ready, so to speak, because there was such a lot of building going on that for her that seemed like a lot of building, obviously. You know, today you wouldn't recognize. But there's always been. I mean, the other thing I do, of course, I've been involved with Dean Lartello for a long time.
Indeed.
And the pace of development has grown and grown, and there is all, you know, there's a lot more awareness, but somehow it doesn't. The vision, if you like, of what Malta should be, or how we want it to be, is you know, still very much, you know, I don't know, we all are overtaken, if you like, I think, by the amount of development and change that there's been, because we're talking about people. So yes, okay, there's a lot more people, but there's a lot more building, there's a lot more everything, so that's why, and it's all happened really very fast. So, you know, there's a question of you either adjust or as you kind of give up, or as you try to maybe change the direction of it, or because you can't really reverse everything, but you can try to maybe make what comes next better, or improve what there is already, or something like that. So it's all part of this, because these travelers that we're mentioning are giving us views of Malta of the past as well. So you know, they are reminding us, if you like, of what there was. And the thing is, there was all that until not all that long ago, because the changes happened all post-Second World War, for sure, and even post-60s, and then, you know, the development continued, and then post-80s, there was a lot of wave, and now it's just, you know, I don't know.
Indeed.
Control. I mean, also, we complain about the environment, all the building, but it's not just the quantity. I mean, the quantity is an issue. There are too many buildings, too many people, and too much everything for this small, very small
space.
But it's also about the quality, you know, because we say quality tourism, quality this, but it's also quality building, because unfortunately, a lot of the building there is around isn't very nice, to put it mildly. It's not just, probably there'd be much less dissatisfaction with all of it if all those built-up streets were actually looking really good. So, okay, they're buildings, but they're nice buildings. It's a nice living environment, et cetera, et cetera. There might be a lot of it, but it's all very nice. But it isn't the case. So you go down streets and so on.
It's not coordinated.
It's not coordinated, and a lot of it is not really well-designed, you know? So so lots of houses,
different
blocks,
shapes,
shops, showrooms, whatever's going up isn't necessarily done in a way that is aesthetically within the context of the street and all these different things that go on. So a lot of the problem is probably there as well, you know.
To go back to naming a few famous people who have either lived here or maybe passed through, came to visit, I do remember reading somewhere that Christopher Hitchens, the famous writer about atheism, and he was lived here as a child. His brother is a British journalist, Peter Hitchens, and their father was in the Navy, so they lived here in the 1950s. And I think Christopher Hitchens has written about his atheism and his militant atheism, shall we say, as in writing one of his books is called God is Not Great, just to give you an idea. But he was influenced by the heavy religious element that he experienced here in Malta in the 50s. And then there were the poets.
Those are, if you like, that is the... Well, Byron had come, basically, he had travelled extensively, Italy, Greece, and so on. And he also came to Malta as part of his travels. You could say that is maybe the end of things which you might call like the Grand Tour and so on. It wasn't quite the Grand Tour, but he travelled around. Mm-hmm. And then there were others like Coleridge, who actually worked here for a while as part of government. So that was where the Casino Malti is, the Casino Maltese is in Valletta today. That was the government treasury, and there were offices in there, and that's where he worked. So lots of little snippets like that. Indeed. Yes. So yeah, there are lots of famous writers, and also, well, famous, maybe not quite to the same extent, but for example, Vera Brittain, who came here during the First World War. So she was English, so she decided during the First World War, when all that, you know, those tragedies, all the, you know, there was so much, such a terrible time, so many deaths and everything going on, she had decided to join to take up nursing. Basically, there was the VAD, I can't remember exactly what it stands for, but a particular kind of nursing structure there. And they had come to Malta on a ship, which I think was called the Britannic, and I think it was kind of the sister ship of the Titanic.
Wow,
at the time.
Yes.
And they had travelled down to the Mediterranean, eventually arrived in Malta.
I think VAD, could it stand for Voluntary Aid Detachment?
That's it. So she was part of that.
In World War I, yes.
They had trained up as nurses and gone to help, you know, out in various places. She had gone to the Mediterranean, ended up, they were stationed here, mm-hmm. all had caught some terrible fever, I don't know what was on this ship, and went to Imtarfa, because Imtarfa was, of course, barracks, but there was also a hospital up
Indeed.
In Imtarfa.
Yes, the building is still there.
His building is still there. I'm not sure what it is at the moment. It was going, the use was up for, it was being changed anyway a few years ago, so I'm not sure what it is at the moment. But anyway, there was a hospital there. And then eventually she got stationed at the barracks in St. George's Bay. So she writes very lyrically, very beautifully about both of these places and about her experiences here at that time. So that's a very different Malta again, because that is Malta very much the British, of course, military and all the issues that were going on then, but also at a time during the war when she felt, you know, her sort of experiences, you know, because of all the difficult time that there was, and emotionally also very difficult, you sort of have this very heightened sensibility, and she had actually, you know, one of these sort of life-changing experiences while mm-hmm. she was here. So you get these kind of snippets of people who are having these special experiences, if you like, and then thinking back much later about their experience Indeed. Here and so on.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about people who would visit Malta, particularly during the Grand Tour, and you mentioned how they'd come here because of the Knights of St. John, the St. Paul connection, maybe they'd see Valletta. Was Valletta really, who was it that described Valletta as a city built by gentlemen for gentlemen and praised it very much?
I don't think it's ever quite. Yeah, I think the quote isn't quite identified, though. That's how it is. It's one of these quotes which goes around.
But Valletta was quite impressive shortly after it was built, in the first 100 years, 200. Not that it isn't today, of course.
Well, it was the capital city, right? Mm. So it was a busy, very busy place, very overpopulated, probably, place. It was very busy. It was densely populated, let's say. So,
The architecture must have impressed people, I think. The fortifications, I suppose.
Yeah, it was an important, or let's say it was an admired city. I mean, yes, the fortifications were as impressive as they are now. And it was a seat of government, and everything happened in Valletta, whereas now, of course, Valletta is more, I mean, there's still the courts there and other things, and, you know, the Prime Minister's office and that kind of thing.
And it still impresses visitors.
Yeah, but then it was the centre of everything, if you like. Mm-hmm. So everyone lived in Valletta a lot of work went on in Valletta, and then people left. There was a different routine, you know, different pattern of life. People went out to Valletta for the summer months, either British travellers went back home, very often mm-hmm. British residents rather went back home, because again, patterns change. For example, today everyone comes to Malta or goes to hot places because they want the sun.
Yeah.
And so they travel in summer in order to find the hottest place they can find. Yeah. You know? Whereas if you go back to especially, let's say, the 19th century, 1800s and so on, that was the opposite. So they would come to the... they always looked for the milder climate. Yeah. So they would go up to the north, to England or wherever, in the summer. And then they would come down south in the winter when it's not so hot. So it was the opposite kind of... sort of travel.
That's really interesting. And that brings me to my point, in fact, that I wanted to make. Nowadays, we promote Malta for the swimming, for the Blue Lagoon, and also for the temples. But at the time of the Grand Tour that we started talking about at the beginning of the programme, the temples hadn't been rediscovered yet, I believe.
Well, by the 80s.
And the swimming wasn't a priority.
No, swimming, certainly not. I mean, people didn't go swimming holidays. Yeah. It just wasn't like that. I mean, I think probably in the early 20th century, people start to, you know, in a limited way, enjoy kind of swimming or whatever. But definitely it wasn't a reason to travel somewhere or anything like that. But the temples, yes, by the 1700s. I mean, I was mentioning people who left also visual record of this. For example, Jean Houel, who was another artist who came in the, I think, in the 1800s, I think 1770s. And he did... because there was an interest in archaeology, which was growing at that time.
They were starting to discover...
Yeah, archaeology in general was a sort of becoming more and more popular. So, yeah, they were starting to discover.
So there are paintings from 200-300 years ago of the remains of like Gigantia or Hajar Im or...
Yeah, not necessarily the whole site, as you might imagine, but bits of things, yes.
And they were acknowledged as being ancient.
Yeah. Ah. Obviously, the knowledge of was limited and different.
Indeed.
But still, yes, they were acknowledged as ancient ruins. And there was always a lot of interest in ruins in general. So the Romantics and people at that time, there was this fascination with ruins in general.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of a something of symbols of how everything, in a way, you know, crumbles away and, you know, sort of reflections on time and on beauty and things like that. Very often, the whole Romantics, you were mentioning Byron and others, they were all very much in love with the idea of ruins. In fact, when they went to Venice at that time, we're mentioning they did go, they, and Ruskin as well, they wrote in their poetry and in their essays and in everything else very much about the beauty of the idea of a ruin. So and how sort of that sort of sense of decay and time and the lost civilization or whatever it is was part of its charm and the whole attraction of things. So yeah, the idea of ruins, temples, and also an interest in archaeology was definitely growing already then, but the knowledge was different.
Indeed,
you know? I mean the kind of
they didn't have carbon
historic
dating.
Knowledge was a different thing.
I think it's time to conclude this edition of Malta Through International Eyes, Minai Nain Baranin. Perhaps we haven't mentioned many people who visited Malta or stayed here. I mean, famously, Caravaggio, the artist. Even more recently, many other people from famously from British entertainment in the 60s and 70s ended up perhaps buying property here or visiting very regularly. So there is that connection as well. But as somebody who... writes and about travel writing. Malta through the ages. What has made Malta worth visiting in the eyes of all these people that we've mentioned? What's so special about Malta? Why is Malta worth visiting, do you think, from what you've researched over the years?
Well, why it's worth visiting now, if you look at the, is something else. But if you look over time, as I was trying to say, people came for different reasons. So if you like, in the medieval period or late medieval, whatever, it was its location at the center of the Mediterranean, maybe was something which was of interest. When the knights were here, the fact that the knights were here in itself was something which was made it, or let's say, gave it prominence because they were a prominent order and therefore Malta was known through them mainly, I'd say. And then, of course, when the British were here, it was also for strategic reasons. The location of Malta was important, so that's another reason why people came. So over time, the reasons for coming here have changed.
Yeah. Visiting scenes of battles, for
example. Yeah, I mean, the reasons change over time, but mainly it was for a long time because of the presence of the order, and then it was also always because of its strategic location, you know, from a naval or military kind of importance and so on. Today, there are other reasons, obviously, for coming here. It's a totally different world. But going back in time, those were the reasons. And then you have these other pockets of people who, as we mentioned, those writers and artists in the 1960s, like Montserrat and those, like the idea of a Mediterranean island and quiet and the sort of, if you like, bit of romantic kind of idea of the Mediterranean.
An olive garden, a bottle of wine, sunshine.
That was the reason at that time.
Entertaining guests, yes, yes.
Yeah, so things change.
The Mediterranean villa sort of thing. Yes. Of course, today, I mean, people could list a number of things why people come here to learn English. There's an extensive
network of English languages. Compared to what I've been talking about today, which is the kind of the historical perspective, those are very recent things.
Yes,
of the last 20 years, 30 years or whatever.
The Film Commission says, you know, people visit here because Malta's a location for various films that people have seen in the cinema.
And there's just general tourism. But these are more recent.
Yes. Some people visit nowadays, just like we Maltese see an offer for a weekend break in Seville. Oh, that looks cheap. Let's do it. So some people just come to Malta. And more recently, which is causing some problems as well and disquiet among certain residents, especially close to where there is clubbing involved, Malta has sometimes been turned into a bit of a clubbing Mediterranean island, equivalent to Ibiza. But that's progress, for good or for bad, and different, as you say, the various reasons over the years, reasons keep changing, don't they?
That's it. Well, yeah, I mean, the historical perspective is one thing, and looking at Malta right now is a kind of a whole different conversation, really.
Indeed. Are you worried about, as somebody who has this country?
Well, worried. I mean, I've, you know, been actively involved in Dean Artello, I'm basically campaigning, you know, for improvements in things for quite a long time. So, yes, there is always that push to make sure that things improve, things are rethought, things are done better and so on. And definitely there is loads of room for all sorts of things. But again, that's a whole other conversation we could have. I mean, there are... You know, they need to rethink what we want, actually, for
That's what
Malta,
I'm trying to say. I mean,
you know? So what kind of Malta do we want to have? And therefore, you know, there needs to be a vision which is not just a piece of paper, but actually which is, you know, where we actually follow in that direction. Because a lot of the types of plans and so on, which are put forward and have been put forward for many years, you know, they go over 20 years, 15 years, 30 years, whatever it is, they're always different ways to interpret how you might implement that part of the plan or how you might give a permit or how you might, you know, change something. So it all depends on what your vision is, okay, what you want to achieve at the end. You can't just look at, you know, either something in isolation or interpret it according to something else. I mean, do you want to create just one big urban space or do you want to have a space which is well, managed differently from, you know, the state of the streets to the state of whether we want greenery in our urban areas or not or whatever, is, you know, things which just make the living spaces, you know. So, but that's more or less for what we want who live here. But I think tourists just want to come to a nice place. So in the end, it all works hand in hand, right? So it's all part of the same thing.
Attractive.
I mean, these are things, some things are just about managing the place in a different way, and some things are a bit more, you know, about you know, big planning issues and so on.
Well,
so
it's been an education. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, Professor Petra Caruana Dingley, who is an associate professor at the Edward Debon Institute for Creative Thinking and Innovation here at the University of Malta, has published various articles and books over the years, including a specific book we made many references to today, a book called Encounters with Malta. Thank you for being a guest on Malta Through International Eyes. Minainain Barani.
Thank you.